The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
An ugly week for markets. The Fed leaves rates unchanged, but rates spiking are spooking investors. And our guest today, Danielle Park, CFA, CFP, and author of Juggling Dynamite. All this and much more on episode number 546 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, the first week of February is done. It's Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast this week and every week, of course. We had quite the week, didn't we? A little bit different moving, a little bit different trend, a different sentiment than we've seen over the last several months. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped a jaw-dropping 1,100 points thereabouts from the high of last week's close, down 666 points alone on Friday. The S&P was off about 112 points from the high, about 4%, just about 4% from the high that we saw last week. And the same is true for the NASDAQ, and we also saw the small caps. I mean, across the board, it was relatively, I guess we have to say, a bloodbath, the worst week in a very long time for markets. And a lot of people are asking, like, what happened? What's changed? What's different? We saw things in earnings, they looked okay, and economics were still pretty good, and nothing really changed dramatically in terms of geopolitical risk, it seemed. And well, we didn't have any bombs. We didn't have any crazy outbreaks of diseases around the world. I mean, what happened? What's going on? Well, the thing that I think, at least from my perspective, what I've been watching for some time, very concerned about, has been the rate on bonds, the yields. What's happening with yields? And we saw that the 10-year Treasury hit 2.8% last week, the highest since 2014. The 30-year Treasury spiked above 3%. That was the last time we saw that was, I think, back in the beginning of 2017, and probably, I guess, about March we saw that. And here's the problem. Here's the issue that we've been looking at. Over the last several years, we've had an ultra-low, a very accommodative Fed. We've had stimulus pouring in. We've had negative interest rates from a variety of countries around the world that are looking to do what they can to stimulate their economies and move past their quote-unquote inflation goal of 2%, this arbitrary number that we know has been bantered around for some time by the various central banks. And now all of a sudden, as we are seeing that the economy here in the U.S. is gaining traction and doing better, the jobs number came out better than expected. We saw that we have a 4.1% overall unemployment rate, according to the statistics by the BLS. We're seeing that manufacturing's on course and sales are doing better. Wage growth, which is a big issue, we'll talk about that in a second, has been getting better. And the idea that the Fed may actually move a little bit more has been entering the minds of many of the players that are involved in bonds. And this is why, in particular, actually, much too early, that for our clients, what we did was we moved to a very short duration and short maturity overall positioning in portfolios that hold bonds. And the reason was that if we saw a change in the dynamic of bonds, if we were at that generational low in yields that we had been thinking was the case for some time, what would happen to bond prices if, in fact, yields started to move up so significantly? And if yields really took off, what's going to happen? Well, I mean, it's a simple math equation. As yields go up, bond prices go down. And for the most part, the longer you are on the scale of maturity, the yield curve, the longer you go to the right, the more potential effect that you have on prices. So if you see a big move, and again, it has to happen, yes, over time, but depending on the swiftness of the actual move will actually dictate how much those move again in terms of relation to where they've been. So if you have a very slow and a very measured pace of yields rising over time, there may not be that much of a significant move very quickly and an adjustment in the prices of bonds, particularly on the long side of the spectrum. However, if you do see a big move, and this is a calculation that you could do called skew, S-K-E-W. If in fact you see a very quick move in terms of the rate of change of interest rates, that's when things get kind of a little out of control. Now, if you look at a chart of the 10-year or the 30-year, you'll see that the last couple of weeks we've seen a significant spike, a very swift move in interest rates. And that is obviously causing some problem with things that are related to interest rates. For example, well, markets for one example, but real estate investment trusts, long-term bond funds, junk bond ETFs, junk bonds themselves. These are feeling extreme pressure because of the very quick advance of yields. And we all know, and we've all said for some time, every one of us out there believes a couple of different things. I really do believe this, that yields are historically low and too low. And it's time for us to actually start to see a rate hike. Now, that's not good for the Fed because they hold a very large trillions of dollars of bonds. And that would actually start to change the valuation of their underlying assets. But they're going to hold them to maturity anyway, so who cares? It's going to possibly cause some problems with things that require lending. For example, houses, cars, other big ticket items. Banks that were loved the last several months because the idea that interest rates could go up and the yield curve would steepen, whereas you would see the curve on the shortest of durations, the shortest maturities, low, the longer end of the range rise. That hasn't happened. I tweeted out a picture of a chart that shows that the yield curve is actually flattening. The short end is coming up, and there's not a lot of movement in comparison. And in a if you look at it on a relationship basis between the short end and long end, there's not a lot of movement in the long end. So what's happening is you're getting a flattening of the yield curve. That's not so good for banks. In fact, banks had one of their worst days, and we'll talk about that also in a second because I have a couple of notes on this that I want to go over with you. But one of the worst days we've seen with the financials was on Friday. It was a bad day overall. But generally, the earnings and outlook that we've seen recently have been coming in, I would say, as expected and perhaps even a little bit better on some accounts. About 75% of companies that are reporting have beat EPS, and this was with a significant rise in expectations over the recent past, where we saw that many analysts have been increasing their EPS estimates, and we've even seen a slight bit more beat on revenue. That's good. That's something I always look at is the revenue numbers, because you can't fudge those as much. You know, with EPS, you can do things like share buybacks, and you can do a variety of, we'll call it financial engineering, to make it sound all nice, you know, not screwing around. No, financial engineering. You know, it's not trickery. It's not anything illegal. It's financial engineering. So when you look at the EPS growth, okay, fine. But the revenue growth is actually pretty good. And that was, again, somewhat expected because we had a weak dollar, and with a weak dollar, you can increase your pricing, especially for those companies that are buying your products on a non-US dollar basis. And you can move up your prices, and that's good. So we saw revenues increase, we saw EPS increase, but now all of a sudden the concern is, well, we have the taxes, and that's obviously going to do, at least for many companies, some good things moving out in the future. We saw companies see a lot of benefit this particular quarter with regard to how they calculated their earnings. And somehow, magically, they've already included the tax cuts, or at least part of The impact of the tax reform is showing up already in their latest quarterly EPS numbers. That's kind of interesting. But midweek, we did have, of course, a Fed meeting. Now, this is the last meeting that Janet Yellen was going to head in terms, you know, be in charge of and be the chief before she is leaving and Jerome Powell is taking over. Now, I don't think there was a lot of question whether or not there was going to be a rate hike or not. I believed all along that while there may be cause for a rate hike because the Fed had talked about possibly three in 2018, the reality is that Janet Yellen had to leave on a high note. She had to leave on a note that, you know, let's not push it up any further. Let's kind of wait till the new head of the Fed gets in there, the new all the new parties that are going to be involved in the rate making decisions will be in there. And she left on, I guess, a note that said, hey, I did a pretty good job here. We had a nice recovery after Bernanke rescued us from the financial abyss. I took over, and here we are. However, I would say two things. First, even though they didn't raise rates, there was a little bit more of a hawkish tilt to their actual meeting notes. Their comments overall appear to be more hawkish, and maybe that too was a parting note from Janet Yellen, who said doesn't want to be saying, well, I'm going to be very dovish into this because she doesn't want to leave with the idea that she caused any hyperinflation if that ever played out. And why not just leave on a neutral note? You know, I've been dovish all this time. I'm going to be a little more hawkish at this point. This way I leave and I can sort of neutralize my entire tenure. So the rate hiking meeting, I think, was a big to-do about nothing. But what happened is we move a little bit further on the week, and where things started to get a little bit nutty was that on Friday, investors saw that the employment situation report for January was better than expected. We saw the 220,000 non-farm payroll jobs were added. The consensus was for about 180,000, and that's a big pickup. Now, there was revisions in the last couple of months. Nothing too dramatic either way. But the real story, if you drill down into the report, was that there was a 0.3% jump in average hourly earnings. And that really stoked the idea that, wait a minute, you know, we see all these companies that are giving out bonuses of one way or another, giving out maybe a pay raise, maybe they're giving out a, you know, the $1,000 one-time bonus, and they're increasing 401k matching contributions. A lot of things going on in the area of wages. And wait a second, one of the big things that really Feds worry about is if we see a jump in wage growth, there will be a pickup in inflation. People will get more money. And let's not forget, if you have gotten your recent paycheck just this month, you'll notice, what do you notice? You notice there's a little bit more money in there, right? Because now that the tax rates have changed a bit, federal withholding numbers have changed, and you probably got a few more bucks to the bottom line. Now, hopefully many of you are putting that towards your 401k retirement plan, not spending it all. Take a little bit of it and save it. But nonetheless, a lot of people, what do? They're going to spend it. They need to spend it. It's kind of like a little raise. And that potentially also is not included in this report yet, because this report didn't include when there was any change in the federal withholding laws. So now the concern that, wait a second, we may see a pickup in inflation. And we saw that the average hourly earnings overall, not only for a month, but for a year, were up 2.9%, which is the highest growth since May of 2009. Now there's talk in the markets that there could be as much as 4 rate hikes in 2018. If they do that, what happens then, right? They got to start moving very quickly. It'll be Powell's first meeting out of the box and out of the gate that he's going to probably have to raise rates. Now, maybe there's also some geopolitical concerns that went into the markets last week as this, you know, we had the idea that, oh, here we go again. Tuesday's coming up. Possibility for a government shutdown. And with all that's gone on since
the passage of a temporary funding bill 2 weeks ago till now, it doesn't look like there's going to be a lot of movement from any of these guys on any of these guys or gals on coming to a centralized resolution. Still a lot of the major sticking points. I mean, the major sticking points that are not resolved. Then we had the finally, which probably also throws a little bit more of a problem into the division with Democrats and Republicans, is that this memorandum was released and declassified with regard to this whole, you know, FBI and spying and the FISA warrants that were put out. And I'm not going to go through all that. But bottom line is it did create some more political instability there and question with regard to how are these guys and gals on both sides of the aisles going to get together to try to resolve this whole government issue. And then, you know what? Let's add one more thing here just to wrap this all up in a tidy little bow. We all knew, you knew. I don't care who you are. I don't care how bullish you are or bearish you are. You knew. Markets were getting a little overheated. It's kind of a little weird the way markets were reacting in January that, I mean, we really didn't have any significant dips then or for the last several months. The bullish of bulls knew it. This is not normal what was going on. The big question is whether it's going to be, you know, is it going to be a one-day wonder, a one-week wonder, or is there more to come? Now, in terms of how things looked at the close on Friday and what's going to probably happen next week or what is the likelihood, oftentimes when you see that kind of a move where you close on the lows, high volume on a Friday, Mondays aren't so pleasant. Could be a rough opening. I would say, by the way, when you're listening to this, that you may want to set up a watch list for those companies that you've looked to get into. Find some real good support numbers way low. I mean, really low. And consider putting in some limit orders in there to buy if you're inclined to buy. You know, we also saw that there's some news after the close on Friday, by the way, that we saw that the Fed put the kibosh on Wells Fargo finally for all their bad actions and things they did over the last couple of years. You know, we had those fake accounts, we had higher fees, we had that insurance scandal. This is unprecedented. The Fed is forcing the removal of several members of the board, restricting growth and other sanctions on this company, and the stock was down another 5% after the close. A quick disclosure, we are short the financials, have a good position short the financials for the last couple of weeks. And next week, we have earnings that are going to continue to roll out, some economics. We're going to see the ISM services on Monday. But the question is how much healing and recovery for Brew's portfolios are going to go on. That's the big issue. So again, I would think that there is going to be a good potential for Monday morning, at least the futures overnight are probably going to show up some kind of wonkiness because Asia's probably going to react first to what happened here in the U.S. Then you're going to have Europe, et cetera. Then we have our open. Just get ready for the potential. That's all I'm saying here because we've seen this before. We've seen then where markets, especially these markets that there's been so many buybacks that have gone on and they're very thin, a lot of companies, they may see very long tails on the downside. I've seen this even last week when we didn't have that much of a market problem. Long tails on the downside. So just keep that in mind and keep a watch on that. Hey, by the way, thanks so much for all the book recommendations that you sent in. I have go through these very quickly before we get to our guest here. I got some great books. By the way, I'll start off with what I decided to read first here on this. And this is a recommendation from Alan Peterson, Freedom's Forge by Arthur Herman. And it's a story of how companies came together, in particular in Detroit and the manufacturing area, to really create all the machinery, armament, munitions, everything behind how we won the war. I'm only up to about, I don't know, page 40 or so. It's fascinating. Really cool read. Really cool read. So thanks, Arthur, on that. Or I'll call you Art. We also have one from Jack. He said, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers by Paul Kennedy. John sent me in. He said, this is actually his own book. AI and Robotics. What's it called? The Robots Are Coming. That's a good one. I'm going to get to that one. Jeff sent in a book recommendation, Risk Savvy, How to Make Good Decisions by Gerd Gingerzer. I think it is. Mark sent in Ray Dalio's book, Principles. He said it provided great tools and more thoughtful and disciplined on that and what to do. He said also Paul sent in a book recommendation, Poorly Made in China, An Insider's Account to the Tactics Behind China's Production Game by Paul Midler. And I think we had one more here somewhere. Somewhere somebody sent in one of Peter Schiff's books. I don't know where that is. Anyway, thanks for sending those in. I do take those seriously. And, some of them I've read already, but some of these I'm going to read. And by the way, you know, reading is just one of those things that every once in a while, get away from the internet, get away from the screen, get away from the Twitter and Facebook and all that other stuff and all this going on with, the instantaneous news. And I spend a little time finding out what's going on with a more in-depth view. So thanks for that. Thanks for your questions. Go over to Ask Andrew on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can very simply send me in your book recommendations or your comments or your questions. And maybe now it's about time to check out some of the strategies we have over there too. We've talked about this. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check it out. We'll send you information on whatever you need. Let's get right to our guest. I think it's really good timing for this discussion. And our guest today is portfolio manager, attorney, and author of the best-selling myth-busting book, Juggling Dynamite, an insider's wisdom on money management, markets, and wealth that lasts. And that's Danielle Park. Hey, Danielle, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Andrew.
So you've been doing this a while. You're actually a CFA as well. You have a lot of education and titles. That's very impressive. It takes a lot of time to do all that.
You kind of need to try and figure out a lot of stuff if you're going to be in the money business trying to advise people and figure out what's going on all around you. So I just kept going to school, learning and learning and taking every exam I could. And at the end of it, I said, oh, no, this is all these people know.
Now, you know, when you look back on it and, you're an attorney and a CFA, and obviously you have, undergrad work. What was maybe it was not even any of these. What's the best education you ever had? In other words, for active use in what you do now.
Best education I had was outside of the textbooks, doing the work in real time for real life people, managing savings starting in the 90s, going through the 1998 sell-off, which turned out it was regarding the Asian crisis and the blow up of long-term capital. But at the time, no one knew exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. That was really a wake-up call for me because I was working on the sell side in the 90s, my first job in the business. And everything was going great. You know, everything was going up in leaps and bounds and everyone was happy. And, then all of a sudden, just in that, in about 4 months there, the stock market dropped 30% in the fall of 98. And no one really knew why. Mm-hmm. And everyone that, was supposedly long-term investor and, just collecting dividends, not worrying about price and all that, panicked and had a complete, meltdown and started, firing us and moving to other advisors. And then other advisors were losing people and they were moving to us. And that was the moment when I realized, wait a minute, this is entirely different in real life than it is in theory. That's the first thing. And secondly, again, having done the education, I thought that I'd have such an illumination of what best to do and how to manage and, get great results for people. And then I realized that there's so much complexity around emotional issues, around emotional behaviors, around greed and fear, and, then just real life implications of people's savings and how volatility is so in theory, everyone says, oh yeah, I have a high volatility tolerance. In reality, almost no one does. Right. So that really changed my life in terms of my understanding of what the job was, if you're going to be actually helping people to, protect and grow their savings. And that's when my partner and I really went back to the drawing board and said, okay, what can we do that will best serve, the best interests of clients instead of just make them feel good through the up cycle and then have them panic and jump out of moving vehicles in the down.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned this whole idea of someone's their thought and their interpretation of their own risk tolerance level. And, you know, it's funny because also being in this business for so many years that what you find, tell me what you think, but what you find is that it's somebody's individual risk tolerance level changes dependent on external influences that really are not necessarily accurate for the long haul. So when you have a market condition and economic backdrop that's very good, and, you know, it looks like what we're seeing recently, everybody's like, yeah, I could handle some risk because all of a sudden we have a very short-term memory, right? And risk goes out the window. Now, on the other hand, when things are just, you know, hitting the bottoms, everybody's like, oh, no. I don't want a lot of risk here, right? I mean, so it's that's a hard thing for clients and people to really get, I think, because we get carried away on both sides.
We do. So I think that you have to, and it isn't a function of intelligence. It's not a function of education. It's not even the most disciplined people, in my experience, will have a very difficult time if their savings start dropping by a lot, and especially if they stay there for an extended period of time. And I think, you know, that is the reality of what we are like as people. And the other thing is, I think, you know, back in the old days before market mania was like such a booming business and everybody was following stocks, you know, people really did have this sense of you kept your savings and guaranteed deposits and you kept it in interest-bearing instruments and you didn't take a lot of risk with your savings. I think people had a real profound sense that they were already facing a lot of risk by being alive in the world, by having loved ones, by having health issues, by having, you know, marital difficulties, by having businesses that go through a business cycle. You know, one of the worst things I think is that people, you know, that are maybe going through they're in their savings years, they're in either a high paying job or a good paying job, steady income coming in, or they're running a business and, you know, suddenly the business is doing the best it's ever done. That's positively correlated with the stock market, right? So their savings have been going up as their income's been going up, and inevitably their spending has been going up. And if you're a business, you've probably expanded your expenditures and taken on more overhead and all that. And then you get to the correction phase or the downturn, the recession, which always comes, by the way. You know, every single decade, there's been at least one and usually two. So when that period comes, everything that the person's been doing suddenly doesn't work, right? If they've been borrowing a lot of money, that becomes a big problem. Even though going, you know, in the expansion, it looked like they could afford it, they could maintain all the payments, all of a sudden they get a cash crunch, right? Now they have to start selling assets typically because they don't have enough cash set aside. In this, it's very common today for people to carry very little cash and to think of credit as what you fall back in times of trouble. But the difficulty is that, you know, all these things can compound at once. So your stress level goes through the roof. And the last thing you want to see if you're trying to manage, you know, perhaps a job loss or, as I say, a drop in your revenue from a business, the last thing you want to see is your out of the fire and into the pan money, I call it, your savings, having it imploding and dropping along with everything else. So you really need to set that up in a counter-cyclical way, like a negatively correlated way, in my experience. You need to have the savings pot with low volatility, with very little drawdown potential, and, you know, keep managing the risk in terms of your own income, your health, your family, and your business. That's the risk where people have, you know, day-to-day discipline that they can do around that. Unfortunately, they tend to toss the savings side over to, you know, product salespeople or, you know, broker dealers who never expect a downturn. They just want a gun for the fences at all times and call that genius. And of course, it's not. They're not actually adding any value. They're just running the table with other people's money.
So, you know, one thing that you said there was that there is recessions. There are recessions. There always have been recessions. There's a cycle and all that. Now, I was under the impression that the whole business cycle was dead. The trough to peak, to peak to trough. I think I was told by even Janet Yellen that, you know, we really don't have a chance of a recession coming in the future because of the way they're masterfully managing the whole process. And my understanding was from the, you know, the inferences from a lot of politicians that, you know, this is the new norm, that no longer are we going to have a situation where we have downturns, it's going to be expansion forever. Am I missing something?
No, well, that would be the common, the parlance, the party line, so to speak. I think it's completely flawed. I think it's hubris at its perfect pitch. It's something that we've seen in other periods in history. I think that, you know, there's all sorts of things you can point at various other peaks. And central banks have really become the rock stars of this add debt and stir era, is what I call it, you know, where there's not been any good idea other than add more leverage. And when it all imploded in 98, they bailed out long-term capital by the banks coming in basically and covering so that they didn't have to take their losses. And that was a profound message, I think, to the institutional speculators out there, that they could, you know, take reckless risk, blow themselves up, and they would be saved by central banks. And I think that has been the scourge of the last 20 years. And we've paid that price repeatedly, you know, with the crash in 2000 to 2002, again with the 07, 08 calamity, and all of it driven by credit, adding more debt. And in fact, now, of course, as you know, we are at the worst debt levels that the world has ever seen. And the levering up phase has been extended by unprecedented efforts. I'll give them that. They have been, this has been kamikaze style central banking. There's no question. And they will very likely maintain their, pensions and perhaps their jobs, for a while longer. But I think that the cathartic cleanse, the end of the secular bear that began from the valuation peaks in 2000, you know, after they bailed out long-term capital and, you know, the stock market went up about 100% in the year and a bit after that. And that was really the peak of the mania, but in fact, I was wrong, because we've had now two more manic cycles. And today, on most valuations that matter, we're even worse than we were at the tech top in 2000. So we learned nothing from these last two implosions because everyone was bailed out and they went right back to following the add debt and stir advocates. But I really think that this next downturn is going to be more severe than we've seen in the last two, believe it or not. And I think that finally we're going to have this, which we need, like a perp walk, where people are brought out and shamed for their horrible leadership and bad decision-making that has cost the world so much. You know, the classic tale, with all the hyperbole and all the, people boasting of late on social media about how much their stocks have gone up in the last year. You know, there's just sentiment indicators, bullish bear spread, nothing, we've never seen it like this since at least the 2000 peak, and in some cases were worse. But basically, I think, the next downturn, there's going to be so little money to save us. There's so little short interest to come back in for buying. There's so little cash on the sidelines. There's so little central bank rate room to cut. There's so little room on their balance sheet. You know, I really think this is the end of an era. And in when that happens, I think it'll be revealed to be a fraud. And even now today, with the valuations and the prices as high as they are, the proof is in the pudding, because savings deficits are at all-time highs in many important pensions. As you know, deficits of trillions of dollars all around the world. People are, as I say, the most indebted and the least saved, the least liquid in their savings. And they're, the boomers are that much older. And there's just so much that has come to a head. We've really earned the next cleansing period.
Well, it's two things, two or three things I'll take from that. First, the whole idea that, there's all this debt out there. And I've said this before, and I haven't said to you, but one of the things that you have to realize, I think, is that the last credit cycle bust was based on debt that was accumulated by individuals, companies, and the banks that lent it to them, right? I mean, and that got, out of control. We know all about that whole story, right? But the problem is that whole debt load for a while was then shifted. And because the central banks were able to bail out, hold on for a long period of time, really to eternity, things till they turned around, they bailed out the banks. They bailed out the credit. They bailed out whoever needed to be bailed out. And they're still doing it, by the way. But the thing now you have to ask yourself is, who bails out the central banks?
Right.
There's only one power that can do that, and way up there, Because there's really nobody else with you know, the ability to do that as we move up the chain and kind of pass along the baton. It's kind of like I lived in an area in Florida, and for a long time there was this incredible rise of housing prices. And I asked in this one area, a lot of Brazilians and Venezuelans were moving, and I said, how is it that we keep on getting this incredible rise? And they said, well, what happens is that the first party buys the house, sells it to his brother or his cousin or a relative or somebody who knows Venezuela. Then they buy it. Then they sell it to the next person. They sell it to the next person. And each person keeps on pushing it down the chain, but also raising the price until somebody's holding that hot potato.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, things are not so good because the last guy holding the ball is the problem.
It's the tale as old as time, Andrew. This is the same thing we've done for hundreds of years. And also, we've had periods throughout history where you have a jubilee, which is a debt jubilee that actually knocks off zeros and says, you know, so bad, so sad, we're not paying any of that back. So when you ask about, you know, who's going to pay the money back, mm-hmm. I think the next round is going to be these, quote, investors who have been insisting they're so genius, the ones who have become billionaires, you know, in the central bank largesse of the past decade. They will have to give back in the terms of writing down assets. I think that's what the world is not prepared for. You know, you look at these long credit abuse periods where it basically the lure of easy money, people become, you know, less careful, less responsible, more, you know, it's like a mental illness sets in and they start just thinking all you have to do is swing for the fences, and they forget about how heavily correlated, as I said, their life, their, you know, their family happiness, their mental peace, their strength, their, you know, their stress levels, their financial stability, how important that is, and how they've literally undermined all of that through these reckless behaviors again in the past decade. So I definitely think that, you know, it's been extended. If I look back in the last 25 years, you know, living through the first 98 to 2000 mania, you know, learning a great deal, calibrating our methodology so that we could navigate through, you know, secular bear period where valuations go from peak to trough and peak to trough, and then finally take, you know, 17 to 18 years to recover the prior peak. We're right back there again. Now, I thought we'd have been further along by now. I really did. But, you know, I underestimated clearly the hubris, as I say, the devotion of central banks and finance-dominated politicians to this obsession with add debt and stir. Because it's this classic, you know, presents the appearance of prosperity and progress up front in quick price hikes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it takes, you know, forever after that to pay down the debt that accompanied it.
I guess one of the things I remember back in about the year 1999, I'd go to a party and I would be immediately surrounded by people because they knew I was in, you know, finance and investments, and they start pitching all these ideas. You know, what do you think about Webvan and Peapod? And what do you think? I made all this money on Netscape today and all, you know, this whole thing. It was really weird, actually. You know, because every time I showed up, it was like the same thing. I'm like, oh, this is just odd. And people that never really talked about this stuff before, we're talking about it. Now, I think the new wave that caught my eye just a couple of days ago of concern of, you know, because you don't always notice this till all of a sudden it starts happening a lot, right? You know what I mean? Like, things here and there. Like, for example, recently, I think it was back in December, I started getting people surrounding me again, asking me about Bitcoin and altcoins. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. What's going on now all of a sudden, right? Mm-hmm. And now the latest thing that I saw was the thing, this new thing, which is sharing your 401k balances on social media and sharing a snapshot of your actual statement on social media that you've become, whether it's a 401k millionaire or whether it's a 401k $100,000 heir, if you will. But that's getting a little bit extreme.
Oh, totally extreme. And I think, as I say, it is this kind of it's indicative of manic episodes. We've seen it repeatedly in history. But basically, you know, people have an obsession. Well, first of all, there's an incredible amount of brainwashing that goes on from the financial propaganda machine, which runs all the media, that sponsors all the events, you know, has even been paying for the so-called, you know, intellectuals to produce from the PhDs to write papers on topics. I mean, this has been, they've been infiltrating the institutions of education even to make sure that all the papers and so-called research supports the thesis, which is be long risk at all times, buy at all times. Good companies are good investments at all times, regardless of price or valuation. That, you know, those are antiquated artifacts in the brave new world of buy, buy, buy. And of course, we've seen that, you know, in 2000, as you say, we saw it in 2007-08. You know, I'd be speaking at different conferences and everyone was obsessed with gold and silver and mining companies. And, you know, China was never going to get enough of our stuff and all that. And of course, it was all, again, the same slippery slope of losing track of what game you're supposed to be playing. You know, if you're in, if you want to be swinging for the fences, you know, basically buying game, buying lottery tickets, going to the casino, I say fine, absolutely do it. But define how much of your net worth you want to have in that game. And with the rest of it, realize that it is a cycle that will take your money from you every 5 or 6 years. And no one will be responsible for that. You know, the institutions and the bankers may get bailed out, but individuals do not. They are left with financial holes that some people never have enough time to dig out of, or they dig out of two or three times, and eventually they just get too old to rebuild. And that's where we are today. So, you know, I think everyone goes, well, you can't, it's like this mental, the programming, right? Well, you can't time markets. So in other words, you have to just be a fool and buy anything and always and never try and take the
profit. My question. No, I have a question for you on this. So, okay, yeah. Let's say I buy into everything that you're saying. You know, I'm not saying you're wrong or I'm just saying, all right, fine. I'm there. I'm going along with you. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, you know, you thought it went on, this whole idea of add debt and stir, as you say, went on a lot longer than you anticipated and that you believe could be. And we don't actually know how much longer it can go on. I mean, we may say we're at the end, but, you know, who knows? But here's the question. So what do you do? So what do you do as an individual? What do you do as an advisor to help out your clients in this circumstance where, on one hand, it's probably not a good idea until things really show up very clearly to maybe, you know, hedge out totally a portfolio, go to cash, go short. What do you actually do?
So here's the thing. Remember when you were a kid and you'd say you want to do something and your parents would say, if Joey wanted to jump off a bridge, would you do it too? You know,
every day.
So first of all, you control your risk on an individual level. So you cannot take your advice from people who are paid to sell you products. That's the first thing. The second thing is the person who's doing the advising has to look at the individual's risk tolerance, not in the classic cliches that the industry loves to use. But my thing is, you know, leverage gives you risk. You should not have leverage on your personal balance sheet. So before you ever get to trying to invest, mm-hmm. pay off your debt.
Okay.
Now, I know in America, there's this whole thing about writing off your mortgage interest. I profoundly disagree that it's in people's best interest to carry a mortgage balance late into their life. The first thing you should do is pay for your consumption with cash and not worry about what money you have to invest until you've at least got your, you know, shelter, your whatever it is. You know, if you're driving a car, don't lease it, buy it. You know, these decisions will help you keep your leverage risk low. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that you don't need to be buying a bunch of risky assets. What you need is valuation discipline. So there are times when things come on sale. There are times like in 2006-07 when real estate crashed, for example, and you could pick up properties that were excellent investments because you could see that there's utility here. It's this house. If I buy it for this, I can rent it for that. I can make, you know, a certain amount of probable profit. You know, you can make a concerted decision based on the price you're paying for it and what the cash flows are likely to be. Mm-hmm. The same thing can happen with equity-based investments. So, for example, you know, in 2006-07, those things were priced for ridiculously low yields and very high probability of capital loss or flat capital return with lots of risk. So they were not a good investment. But if you waited and kept your powder dry, and I do mean in some cash-like equivalents and guaranteed deposits and certified deposits, those sort of things, and, you know, short government bonds, that kind of thing that preserves your liquidity, there is going to be opportunity. There was then. We were able to buy things in, you know, the spring of 2009 with dividend yields that were 8% and 9% because we hadn't participated in the loss cycle, because we had strong financial strength and emotional and psychological strength with our clients. We were able to then use their cash, which had been carefully set aside, to buy things that made investment sense again. And we can do that again. You can bank on it that because the masses don't do math, the masses are running around like, you know, crazy people with their eyes glazed over hoping to get rich or something. Many of them are already, you know, accumulating enough wealth that they would just have personal discipline on how they're spending, what debt they're using and all that good stuff. So, you know, if only it worked, if only blind optimism and ignoring valuations was a strategy that worked, then I'd say, okay, fill your boots. If you think you want that kind of volatility and you don't think you're going to jump out of a moving car, yes, you will. But if you think you won't, right, then I say, fine, do it that way. But that does not work for real life people, both because they get older with each cycle and they don't have enough time to grow back their lot.
One of the problems, though, that you can run into is, like, this cycle is a really good example. So what you have is a client who agrees exactly with what you're saying. And, you know, you say, okay, you know what, we're going to put some money aside. We're going to put some money in safety. We're going to, you know, I think things are a little overvalued at this point. Also, the business cycle, just by the very nature of how cycles work, just in timing perspective, is a little bit longer than tooth from the historical levels of where expansions die, you know, in terms of the length of time. And they're like, okay, that's fine. But now this thing goes on for a couple of years and they get, you know, they go out to dinner with their friends and their friends, oh man, that stock market, I'm making so much money. And they're saying, oh, you know, I'm making money, but you know, how'd you do? I'm doing okay. Yeah. You know, I made some money. But my advisor has me a little bit more slanted towards bonds. Oh my God, that's terrible. You know, you should be more in the markets and all that. And now what happens is the first dinner, second dinner, third dinner, you're dealing with this. Months go by and you're dealing with this. And then nothing happens. All of a sudden, where that ends up going sometimes, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the client ends up saying, well, I can't deal with this. I feel like an idiot, right?
You're exactly right, because you've been doing this job a long time too. You've lived this. Exactly right. So I say clients play a leading role in their own bad results. The statistical, you know, research proves that people are not buy and hold investors. They think they are during the up cycle, and then they cash out at the bottom, and they lock in their losses, and they spend years trying to grow back their money, and they get most aggressive when prices have been going up the longest, and they feel like, you know, Joey's making money. So there's no question. The only thing, and I say it's this incredible slippery slope of mental illness around these speculative episodes that we are all susceptible to. So the only thing you can do is actually steal your personal discipline. So an advisor, the way the system is completely messed up is that people come to advisors thinking the advisor's going to, quote, make them rich. And their job is to, you know, whip their dog team and make it run and their savings. And that is not the advisor's job. The advisor's job is to have a rule set around what kind of risk exposure makes sense at all for this human being in their time frame with their resources and all that. So, you know, the idea that, you know, first of all, you structure your accounts with low risk and volatility exposure because life is full of risk and people don't handle it well. That's the first thing. And you don't change that just because prices are going up. As a matter of fact, risk goes up with price. So, of course, you do have to educate clients. We write, we speak, we talk, we do everything in our power to help our clients understand why they are actually in the driver's seat, because we can give them the best advice in the world and they have to stick it. And they have to stick it through a full cycle, not from trough to peak, which is what all the, you know, the people, I call them the false prophets. What they love to do is brag about their false prophets at the peak of the cycle. They never talk about, you know, how they've done through the last bottoms. And if you measure it from, you know, peak to peak, they've just got back to where they were. They never talk about a full cycle because they don't have a strategy for that. The strategy is let's hope it never goes down. Well, yeah. That's a ridiculous strategy.
Right.
So I agree with you. An advisor, you know, can't be selling and be paid more to put people in greater risk. And unfortunately, most of the business is that way. People are paid a higher fee to get more capital into equity risk. That's the inherent bias of the system. Even people that are not, you know, selling products for commissions, but are fee-based managers, most of their fee schedules have a greater portion of fee paid on equity exposure. And clients think that's good. They think, oh, that'll make them work harder. It's not good. It just means that they're going to have a greater incentive to put your risk, your capital at greater risk. What you want is a system that always manages the risk to keep it on as muted and controlled and intelligent as possible. And yes, there's a portion, as I say, of each cycle where evaluations get really attractive. Just like if you can just think about that house crash that happened, you know, where, for example, houses in Florida went down by 60%.
Yeah,
you know, right?
That's where I am.
Exactly. So you know when there's good value because it used to be X and now it's Y. And holy cow, yield rents and mm-hmm. the dividends being paid just tripled in terms of the amount of yield you're getting for the same dollar. You know, so obviously there's great times to add some things on an investment thesis, not on a wild speculative racing after a moving train thesis. Yeah. And that's why individuals have to they have to get a grip. And unfortunately, I agree with you. It's very difficult. Very few people can sustain the drip, drip, drip of the financial propaganda or their buddy's brother at a dinner party. They have to always think to themselves, you know, and here's the other thing. People brag about their wins and they never talk about their losers.
Well, of course. But, you know,
that's the thing. So,
no, I hear you. I mean, that happens all the time. I have a couple of clients that are my contrary indicators. So I have this one client who calls me when the markets are getting pounded, let's say, you know, she calls me up and says, oh my God, what's happening? Should I pull out?
Yeah.
And it's always within a day or two of the bottom. And just recently she called me within a week and she said, should we get more aggressive? I know that's anecdotal and silly.
But
there's always one of those clients.
What I would say about that lady is that her risk exposure is too high. And you can tell that because every time the thing starts to drop, she starts to panic.
But that tells me she's got too much exposure to begin. Right. But she could have the markets could be down 10%, but her portfolio is down 1%. She'll still panic.
Yeah. People don't like to lose money.
Right.
They don't.
Right.
I know. They'll say, what's going on? Why is it down 1%?
Right.
And be like, well, you know what? You shouldn't be in publicly traded markets if your tolerance is zero for any downside whatsoever.
Yep.
But that said, you know, I don't think they should be exposed to the extent that they can lose 20% of their portfolio and everyone think that that's fine.
Well, as long as the other guy loses 20%, you're fine. Well, everybody's down 20%. I'm good. Right? That's what you hear all the time.
It's much better to be countercyclical, though, and be buying when they're selling. That's much, much more empowering. And compound returns are better over a full cycle, as I say.
Mm-hmm. So in the last 2 minutes that we have here, and we're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with Danielle, her book, all that good stuff, on disciplinedinvestor.com. Look for episode 546. The last 2 minutes, from the things that I've read in your discussions here, you definitely seem to believe that there's going to be a significant decline. We're not talking about 5%, which these days is significant, but you're talking about, you know, something heralding in fear and panic and running in the streets naked kind of stuff, like 25 to 30, 40% potentially.
Well, that would be actually mild in these conditions. You know, we, as I said, measure similar risk parameter as we did in 2000 and as we did in 06, 07. So those both saw 50 plus declines. Tech came down 78%. That is literally the kind of ballpark we're in, not because I say so, and not because, you know, this is such an unusual thing. This is actually what markets normally do after they've been this overstretched, you know, volatility suppressed this long, this much leverage thrown at the thing, this little homework and math being done, people buying indiscriminate cash flows flooding in from fund managers and ETFs, you know, passive. It's the mean reversion always comes. And when it does, it takes back that prior exuberance in the form of a a large downturn. And this is not me, you know, I'm actually an optimistic human being. I actually love being alive and see lots of great things to look forward to. But unfortunately, over leverage and overvaluation is, as I say, it's like driving 200 miles an hour, drinking vodka and texting. At some point, you're going to wipe out, and it's going to wipe out, you know, more than just yourself. It's going to wipe out people around you. Even the people who are in these instruments thinking they're investors or conservative or there for income, those things will get wiped, and they will be ancillary damage to all the speculation and leverage that's in the system.
Well, let's hope you're wrong, but I tend to agree that things are a little bit out of hand. Danielle Park, thank you for joining us today. And like I said, we'll have all your information over on the website at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Andrew.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. All right, so you can't get any better timing on a guest booking than that. I mean, talking about how we should have some cash on hand or, you know, opportunistically looking to make sure that portfolio risk is aligned with what our real level of risk is, and then being able to pounce on prices that make more sense. Looking to, you know, the whole idea of portfolio management, and not just simply looking at this whole idea of, oh, you know, let's just hit a home run all the time, or, you know, having a little bit of powder dry on the side to do. I mean, listen, again, you couldn't get any better timing. And that's how we planned it, by the way. Not really, but it worked out pretty well. So thanks so much, Danielle. Again, we'll have all of the information on where to reach out to her. Some of her great articles that she wrote recently, talking about end of year on a word on analyst forecasts. And she wrote another one on about a week and a half ago, Fun with S&P Snakes and Ladders, all on juggling dynamite. But again, it'll be there. Thanks again for joining us. Hope you enjoy your Super Bowl weekend. And should be a lot of fun there. And then we'll see you again next week with some great guests, some great ideas, some great insight. By the way, hopefully you're listening to DH Unplugged. We put some great stock ideas each and every week on there. We have a game that we play called Close to the Pin with you, and you can win some prizes, as well as have some great discussion with myself and John C. Dvorak on the areas of business, finance, technology, and back and forth. So make sure on Tuesdays, if you want to listen live, it's streaming with chat room on dhunplugged.com, or you can simply just download the podcast over on iTunes or anywhere else right on the site. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.